Thank you all for coming out tonight. It's a great pleasure to have been invited here this evening. The Bowersmith Library is really very dear to my heart. When I returned to live in Adelaide in 2005, it was the first place I came to. I started a master's here. And after 17 years living on an island in the Irish Sea with access to only very basic libraries, I did feel as though I'd returned to civilization. I'm here. I launched a novel a few years ago downstairs in that gorgeous old reading room, and I'm here constantly delving into the library's treasures, so it's especially pleasing to be invited here to speak about my book, Quiet City, and also I'm thrilled to know that it has a home here on the shelves. So Quiet City is a book about the now heritage-listed West Terrace Cemetery. It's the place that Barbara Hanrahan described in her diaries as the most poetic place in Adelaide. And I know that when I read that description, I studied the diary entry carefully for any hint of irony, but found none. Later, an opportunity arose to speak to Barbara's partner, Joe Steele, about it, and he confirmed that Barbara had thought that the West Terrace Cemetery was beautiful and poetic, and that they'd often gone there to visit her family's grave. And when I finally went there myself, I realised that Barbara Hanrahan would have loved the stone angels, because angels are a recurring presence in so many of her prints. And of course, those at West Terrace Cemetery are particularly beautiful. Until I began to walk in West Terrace Cemetery and to gather the material for this book, I thought of myself as primarily a novelist. So it was a surprise to find myself working on something so packed with dates and with the real names of real people. And although as I got further into the research, I began to wonder whether the writing of fiction and of history were really so very different. But before I approach such a tricky topic, I thought I'd begin by telling you a story, because winter nights are perfect for storytelling. And by rights, we ought to be gathered around a hearth with a fire burning and a storm outside. We have to imagine it, because it's actually been a rather nice day in Adelaide. It's a tale of two shipwrecks, and on opposite sides of the world, with the loss of many lives and a great fortune in gold, and there were many acts of heroism, days of unimaginable endurance, and some racehorses and parrots and Charles Dickens thrown in for good measure. The story's real beginning is in Adelaide in August of 1859, but I'm going to take a novelist's liberty with structure and start a little later in the year on the other side of the world. In December of that year, 1859, Charles Dickens must have read in the newspaper a graphic account of the wreck of a ship called the Royal Charter, and he decided to travel to the village of Llanallgo in Anglesey to inspect the site of the wreck. The steam clipper had sailed from Melbourne with 498 passengers and many thousands of pounds in gold. It was bound for Liverpool. And on the 26th of October, the Royal Charter was on the last leg of its voyage and only 30 or so miles from its destination when she was caught in the worst gale of the century, as I think around 200 ships were wrecked that night in British waters. Many of the passengers, and I think this is what caught people's imagination and probably appealed to Dickens, many of the passengers were miners who had made their fortunes on the Australian goldfields, and they were returning home to set themselves up in new, affluent lives. They must have dreamed of this and been inspired. It must have sustained them, the whole idea of this, during the years of hardship at the diggings. The storm, though, was so bad that for a long time afterwards, it became known as the Royal Charter Storm, and it became a yardstick by which other storms were measured. So the ship came towards Linus Point to begin the homeward stretch. The gale turned to the northeast and pushed it mercilessly towards the rocky shore. One by one, the anchor chains snapped, and just before dawn, the Royal Charter grounded on the sands and the rising tide began to smash her against the rocks. Of the almost 500 on board, only 39 survived the night. No women or children survived. The Royal Charter was only 4 years old. It was like it was the best ship of its day. It was one of the fastest ships. The gold that the passengers had struggled so hard to acquire was no help to them as the stricken vessel broke apart. Many were wearing gold belts or clinging to gold-laden luggage or wearing garments with gold sewn into the linings. Later reports suggested that perhaps the captain's judgment was impaired that night by heavy drinking on the leg from Queenstown to Holyhead. In the aftermath of the disaster, Dickens recorded in chapter 2 of a book called The Uncommercial Traveller, which you can get from from the library here, in which I borrowed, the heroism. He talked about the heroism of the Reverend Stephen Ruse Hughes, who cared meticulously and with great humanity for the dead, writing over 1,000 letters to bereaved relatives. And I'll read a little bit now from the Uncommercial Traveller, because what I love so much about this story is that it starts on our, you know, it starts here where we can actually go and look at a site, and then we have this narrative about what happened on the other end of it by Charles Dickens. He says, "Even as I stood on the beach with the words, 'Here she went down,' in my ears, a diver in his grotesque dress dipped heavily over the side of the boat and dropped to the bottom." So Dickens has gone there in December, the very end of December, so it's a while after the ship's gone down. "But on the shore by the water's edge was a rough tent made of fragments of wreck, where other divers and workmen sheltered themselves and where they had kept Christmas Day with rum and roast beef, to the destruction of their frail chimney." So these divers, they actually made a shelter out of bits of the wreck, and they had their rum and their roast beef on Christmas Day. It's amazing. "Cast up among the stones and boulders of the beach were great spars of the lost vessel and masses of iron twisted by the fury of the sea into the strangest forms. The timber was already bleached and iron rusted, and even these objects did no violence to the prevailing air the whole scene wore of having been exactly the same for years and years. And yet only 2 short months had gone since a man living on the nearest hilltop overlooking the sea, being blown out of bed at daybreak by the wind that had begun to strip his roof, getting up on a ladder with his nearest neighbour to construct some temporary device for keeping his house over his head, saw from the ladder's elevation, as he looked down by chance towards the shore, some dark, troubled object close in with the land." And he and the other, descending to the beach and finding the sea mercilessly beating over a great broken ship, had clambered up the stony ways, like staircases without stairs, on which the wild village hangs in little clusters as fruit hangs on boughs, and had given the alarm. Of course, the bringing up of the bodies from this wreck was a massive undertaking for such a small village. 10 shillings had been paid, according to Dickens, for the bringing up of each body to the church, but the way was steep and a horse and cart were necessary, and 3 or 4 men, and all things considered, it was not a great price, and the people were none the richer for the wreck, for it was the season of the herring shoal, and who could cast nets for fish and find dead men and women in the draught? It is a little church of great antiquity. The bodies were brought to the church in this village. And he says that there is reason to believe that some church has occupied the spot for thousands of years or more. The pulpit is gone, and other things usually belonging to the church were gone owing to its living congregation having deserted it for the neighbouring schoolroom and yielded it up to the dead. And 44 shipwrecked men and women lay here at one time awaiting burial. Many of the men were bringing over parrots and had receipts upon them for the price of the birds, and others had bills of exchange in their pockets or in belts. Pitch had been burnt in the church as the readiest thing at hand, and the frying pan in which it had bubbled over a brazier of coals was still there with its ashes. Here there lay at one time 145 bodies that had come ashore from the wreck. All the drowned were buried in their clothes to supply the great sudden demand for coffins. The vicar had got all the neighbouring people handy at tools to work the livelong day, and Sunday likewise. In the churchyard, so much of the scanty space was already devoted to the wrecked people that the villagers had begun to express uneasy doubts whether they themselves could lie in their own ground with their forefathers and descendants by and by. Now, a little before this happened, and I promised two shipwrecks, earlier in the same year, the steamer Admella had sailed from Adelaide bound for Melbourne on the morning of 5th of August 1859. I'm sure that many of you who are interested in history will have read of the wreck of the Admella. That, by the way, is a memorial that's on the coast where the Royal Charter went down, and it's commemorated there. So the Admella left Adelaide for Melbourne in 1859. All was going fine. The people were sitting around having a game of cards below decks when one of the horses fell, or something happened. One of the horses below decks fell, and in order to try and right it in its stall, the captain changed course slightly. It's unknown really whether he ever changed back again or what happened, but the ship ran aground on Carpenter's Rocks. One of the interesting things that I love is that this painting by James Shaw, who's also, by the way, buried at West Terrace Cemetery, and this painting is in the Adelaide Art Gallery. So that's how all the connections are, that you can go to the art gallery and have a look at these early paintings, these colonial paintings, and you can pop up to West Terrace Cemetery, and actually I'm sure James Shaw would quite like a visit. And not many people have been to see him in quite a very long while. But from the date, he actually painted this the year before the wreck, 1858. So it wasn't wrecked till the following year. But what always gets me is that little cross down in the bottom left-hand corner. It's like some spooky, strange thing there. As if he knew, as if, you know, he had some presentiment what was going to happen. A few people painted the Admella. This one was the rescue. And, of course, with the Admella, the ship broke up and people clung to the wreck for days. They were there for nearly a week. There were horses on board, and they were the race horses that I promised you. They belonged to Hertel Fisher, who was the son of Sir James, the colonial... Was he the registrar? I was saying to somebody earlier that I've got to the age where when I learn something new, I have to forget something I already know. And there's so much in this book that you'll imagine that I've forgotten quite a lot. Hertel Fisher and his brother George were on board the Admella with some horses that they were taking to Melbourne for a big race meeting. George drowned, and some of the horses went overboard, and the people that were clinging to the wreck, of course, the rescue was protracted, the seas were very heavy, somebody had to get ashore, take a rope, then they had to get to the lighthouse, and the lighthouse keeper had to borrow a horse, and then on and on it went until news got back to Adelaide, and finally the people that survived were rescued. But strangely enough, Hertel Fisher survived, and his horse, the Barber, also survived, and he walked the horse a long way. It might have been as far as Geelong, where he was able to board a train and get the horse to Melbourne, and it did go into the race, and it came last. And it was the sentimental favourite. Everyone, of course, wanted it to win because it had been through this terrible wreck and it had swum to shore and all the rest of it. It came last, and it never won another race, which was really very strange. So, you know, horses are incredibly intelligent animals, and obviously it was a deeply traumatised creature. So Charles Hill also painted the wreck in 1859, of course. Charles Hill is also buried at West Terrace Cemetery, and he is dearly in need of visitors because his grave, for such an illustrious artist, is really in very poor condition. So there are lots of artists at West Terrace Cemetery. Anyway, where are we? The Admella, the few survivors have been rescued. The thing about it was that there were some passengers who were going to catch the Admella to Melbourne and from there pick up the Royal Charter. One of these, Robert Forsyth McGeorge, missed the boat. And when he heard what happened to the Admella, he wrote to his family in Scotland saying, "Thank God I didn't get that boat. Did you hear what happened to it? It was shocking, blah, blah, blah." He got the next boat to Melbourne and he caught the Royal Charter. Oh. I know, it's that thing about the hand of fate, isn't it? You know, you don't really want to test it. Robert Forsyth McGeorge, and what I love about the threads of these stories is they stretch from these distant places and come to rest in a quiet spot under a pine tree at West Terrace Cemetery. And unravelling these connections, this is a memorial for Robert Forsyth McGeorge's family. And you can see there that it commemorates the fact that he perished in the wreck of the steamship Royal Charter on the coast of Wales. Unravelling these connections is one of the great joys of my research. So Robert Forsyth McGeorge established the first house in the suburb of Erbray. He named the suburb of Erbray after his old home in Scotland. And the house was later overbuilt by Waite House, which is now part of the University of Adelaide. He came, I think, with his wife and 10 children. So we're fortunate to be able to still see and touch this history because the site has been threatened with closure almost since the beginning. During the Dunstan era, it was weedy and unloved, and it came perilously close to being lost forever, or perhaps worse, having its monuments grubbed out and the grave sites greened over to make some kind of rather twee pioneer park. Now, Don Dunstan was marvellous in many respects, but he appears to have been indifferent to the unique historical value of this site, because it was on his watch that paperwork was signed to return West Terrace Cemetery to parklands, and some tree planting ensued, which eventually caused problems to some of the old graves. But for once, government apathy worked to the public good. Ministers did nothing. And while they did nothing, there was time for a heritage survey, which was carried out by Dr. Robert Nichols, the historian. And that survey was instrumental in saving the site for us and for future generations. I wanted to talk a little bit about Caroline Carlton. And it's always just, it interested me from the beginning that one of the early sextants of the cemetery, or one of the early people that lived there in that little cottage at the entrance, was a poet. And so Caroline and Charles Carlton arrived in South Australia in 1839 on the Prince Regent. It was a very a terrible journey. It was a particularly hard one. There were, of 199 people, there were 23 deaths. Now, Charles had been a medical student at Guy's Hospital, and he met Caroline, and she was a very beautiful, very educated lady. She spoke Italian and French. She played the harp and the piano. Her family had been French aristocrats who had fled, the troubles in France. And they met, and he was also, I think, quite arty. Although he was a medical student, he'd written a book and illustrated it with drawings. He liked to draw and paint, and I think it was probably their interest in the arts that drew them together. They got together, and of course they soon had two children, and I think it was the pressure of providing for his family that meant that Charles didn't really finish his medical training. So he wasn't quite a doctor by the time they decided to come to South Australia. And I was really excited. I gave a talk at Burnside Library during History Month, and someone came up to me afterwards, and she was Caroline Carlton's descendant. And so, I was so excited to actually meet someone from the family that's come down. And she told me that they've all had Carlton in their name. And she told me a little bit more about Caroline and Charles and how he acted as medical officer on the ship, although he hadn't volunteered to do that. It's just that the doctor never turned up at the sailing. And somebody said, "Oh, well, you were at Guy's Hospital. You can do it." So that's how it went. They they did this journey, and despite Charles's best efforts, both their own children died on the voyage. So they arrived in South Australia, and Caroline must have wondered what on earth she was doing. The family did one or two things. They opened a little chemist shop. They tried, but, you know, the colony was going through quite hard times, and looking at the reports of the newspaper reports and so on, where they actually pop up and you can read about them, you have this sense of problems gathering around this family, of them getting to more and more desperate straits. Charles was appointed the sexton at West Terrace Cemetery, and that must have been somewhat of a relief. The cemetery was different in those days. It was there were fewer people buried there. It was quite park-like, and if you were to believe some of the reports, people went there on a Sunday just to walk around because it was quite nice. So in 1859, which was the same year as the Admella went down, Caroline Carlton entered the Gawler Poetry Prize. And I think things must have been quite desperate at home. Charles, for a start, had tuberculosis, and he was quite ill, and she was really running the cemetery. She had entered the prize with a pen name, Nil Desperandum. I think she was... obviously, it tells a story, doesn't it? And she won the prize, and I think we could... Many of us, most of us here, could probably sing the lyrics of her song, The Song of Australia, which to me is just... I learned it at school. It's a lovely song. So she won it for the lyrics. Some readers of the South Australian Gazette and Colonial Register were stinging in their criticism of Caroline's winning poem. It was an ominous fact that a lady gained the laurel with a poem that had the sweet softness of the female mind, which characteristic almost unfits it for a patriotic song. Cantator of Gulwa wondered whether a pair of analytical chemists could throw light on the extraordinary combinations of colour depicted in the poem, singling out rosy light and azure. Another critic considered the poem to be calm, soft, gentle and feminine, suitable to be sung by a cluster of juveniles at a tea party. A national song, it was proposed, ought to be short, bold, masculine and full of fire. And in a letter to the editor, I love this, somebody called T moaned that the prospects of the colony were already sufficiently gloomy that with 93 poets, we are in almost a hopeless condition. The writer objected to importing poets rather than poetry. Settlers should not waste time scribbling poems when they could be getting on with their work, and nor should judges waste money on the miserable cudgel brain rhyming submitted to them. So that was what Caroline Carlton had to put up with. The music for that song was written by Carl Linger. Of course, he didn't have to put up with anything like that. And he's got a massive memorial at West Terrace Cemetery. I think it's the single biggest plot. It's got a flagpole and everything. Whereas Caroline has... I think she's got a little plaque on his site somewhere. But really what happened was that in 1861, Charles Carlton died of tuberculosis, and Caroline appealed to the governor to appoint her as superintendent in his place. She'd been running the cemetery throughout the final years of her husband's illness, but the response from the chief secretary declared that the position required an oversight and decision such as no lady of education could be expected to possess. Caroline pursued the matter, but her appeal was rejected, and from 15 applications, Henry Edward Brooks was chosen for the position. So Caroline was left without an income. She did almost the only thing that she could do. She opened a school. She tried to teach. She went bankrupt. And she eventually went to Cadena to live with a daughter. She caught a cold there, a fatal chill, and she died in a house that was owned by the mining magnate William Horne, who donated to Adelaide the statue of Venus, which is on North Terrace, just by the way. He enjoyed poetry, and I think he was fond of Caroline, and the house at Matter House up there is now a museum. Of course, the Song of Australia, the Queen Victoria was presented with a copy of the music, and King Edward VII also requested a copy of Mrs. Carleton's book of poems, and she released this other little book of poems a year after, I think, the Gawler Poetry Prize, and they're called South Australian Lyrics, and they're all lovely poems in the style of the era about various things in South Australia. So that was the Carltons. The historical novelist Hilary Mantel says that nations are built on wishful versions of their origins, stories in which our forefathers were giants of one kind or another. And it was just this kind of wishful history I wanted to avoid in Quiet City, rather than the lives we are already familiar with. For example, those of the people who are important enough to be buried in the Kingston allotments there. I wanted to record the dramas and the everyday tragedies that affected ordinary people. With every year that passes, their stories slip further away from us, with many having already passed out of living memory. And I wanted to salvage stories like the one that unfolded when an Adelaide cabinetmaker took his family boating at Glenelg on a Sunday morning in 1860, and the unbearable consequences in the winter of 1918 of two young boys playing soldiers. Even the bizarre and perhaps permanently impenetrable story of the man who went into his city office on a Saturday morning, read a passage from a novel, turned down the corner of the page, and then shot himself in the heart. The 19th century historian Lord Macaulay said, "History has to be burned into the imagination before it can be received by the reason." So these are some of the stories that burned into my imagination and which I gathered into this book. There's only enough time to talk about a tiny sample of them tonight. So if you want to know what happened in those particular cases, you're going to have to read the book. I've often found the best books are those that grow out of a desire on the part of a writer to read a particular book. They look but can't find it, and they end up writing it themselves. Quiet City came about in this way. On early visits to the site, I could see that what was there was important to me, but I didn't know why. I searched for a book to tell me what I was seeing, and in the end, I had to write that book myself. I feel as if I can skite quite shamelessly about this now, in a way that I couldn't if the book was a novel, because I didn't invent these stories. I only gathered them, and they're stories that belong to all of us. Quiet City is also a book about walking and the value of spending time alone in a quiet place. And this was something I came to realise only slowly, how little we register the busyness and the noise of the living world until we step outside it. And while there's plenty to distract the walker in an old cemetery, and the dead do clamour for their stories to be remembered, to be told, walking there among them can sometimes pull things into perspective. It can make us feel more intensely the privilege of being alive. The book works on a few different levels. It can be a guide so that you can read a story and go to the cemetery, and the book will tell you how to find the relevant gravesite. It encourages readers to go and look and to wander and make their own discoveries. But if the physicality of the walking is a problem, then it also allows me to do the walking for you. In some respects, the site's unchanging pattern of roads and pathways with that, walking there has more in common with the meditative practice of pacing a labyrinth or with being lost within a sizable maze. Mazes and labyrinths are often confused, or the terms are used interchangeably. But the two have distinct and opposing purposes. A maze is a puzzle designed to trick the walker into getting lost, while the gentler labyrinth leads the walker towards its centre. Of the two, I prefer the labyrinth, for life already presents enough puzzles, enough dead ends, enough islands in the design that negate the hand-on-the-wall method of maze navigation. Like the labyrinth, walking in the cemetery does shepherd one's thoughts towards a private centre, even though on occasion what unfolds could be anything from an historic event to the cycle of endless renewal symbolised by bulbs, to the path beside the abyss that constitutes living with the knowledge of our own and our loved ones' mortality. For a place where so much grief has gathered, the cemetery has a palpable calm. That's Sir Dominic Daly's grave, by the way. The urn is missing from the top. And I wonder if perhaps this calm is its true function, aside from the aspect of crude disposal. as a site where grief can culminate and quietly disperse. Walking there, even while engaged in some harmless seasonal quest, perhaps to inspect the fruit-laden kwandongs or to check the progress of the pretty blue-flowered Peruvian lilies, I find myself unconsciously absorbing the whispered message of the physical world's impermanence. Buddhism has a meditation on impermanence. Its aim is to encourage calm acceptance of the transitory nature of everything in the world, but also to bring about the realization that humans have the power to change, to transform their own lives. There's an even more confronting death awareness meditation. Confronting because death, although everywhere, is habitually shoved to the furthest, darkest corner of our minds. But Buddhism teaches that by practicing the death awareness meditation, we learn to decide what is truly valuable. A constant awareness that life is fleeting means we will not squander time but spend it wisely. So walking in the cemetery opens a subtle pathway through this difficult practice. Whether we know it or not, the site, like a labyrinth, guides us through all the stages of the death awareness meditation. The other great pleasure during my many visits was the chance to closely observe the natural world. And observations of this nature do pepper throughout the book. For instance, bulbs push up in the pathways, escaped over time from the old graves. There are scented jonquils and hyacinths, and the drought-resistant Scilla peruviana with its strappy leaves and heads of starry blue or white flowers. Birds tour everywhere. Down in the Jewish section, crows glide from the treetops to stalk about on the lush grass. They've laid claim to this area between the old Jewish graves and the Linger Memorial. At the height of summer, they are the dusty black of old top hats, but in winter, their blue-black feathers are burnished to a wicked sheen. Elsewhere, there are parrots and cockatoos circle noisily against the clear cobalt Adelaide sky. I'm told that there are foxes here with lairs that radiate out into the adjacent suburbs, and I imagine them as the night watch patrol of these paths, their cubs learning to hunt among the headstones. Now, I've come fortuitously to this slide because this is one of the things that I'm quite proud of in the book, in that all the time that I was walking there, I would come across this particular site and wonder what was there, because it looked very, very old to me. And also the writing, there was this writing which was almost readable, but not quite. You could pick a few words, and I desperately wanted to know what it said. I photographed it in many different lights and took it home, and there were two side by side, and this one was the most damaged. You can see this is the most damaged. I took the photographs home and I blew them up so I could try to actually decipher what was there. I got a few words: Frederick drowned in the same grave and a date. And I couldn't take it any further. And this really haunted me for a couple of years during the writing of the book. And I had almost got to the point I was just going to give up on this. And also, on the grave on the far side, I could, in one of my photographs when I blew it up, I could also see the signature carved in, J. Monk, of the first sextant of West Terrace Cemetery. And that was quite rare. So that also made me want to find out what this was about. One of the lovely volunteers who worked there, finally I chatted to him, told him, that I was struggling with this. And he went away and somehow or another he found an old map. And by looking up sites around and about this one, he finally came back to me with two names, Bailey and Hancock, he said. Those. And once I had the names and I had the date, I was able to find out that this was actually a wonderful story. It was indeed a very early grave, and the two men had died. Hancock had actually, he was Irish and he was related to the Irish aristocracy. Yes, this was the state of it. He went with Colonel Light on his exploratory expedition of the Barossa Valley. So he was in his 30s, he came from Ireland. I think he was really dashing, he could ride horses, he was really handsome. should think all the young women and, you know, mothers in the colony were sort of chasing after him. And he established a little farm somewhere up towards the Barossa and Light camped there. And if you read Light's diary of his Barossa expedition, you'll find Hancock mentioned and how he camped there. Anyway, Hancock's neighbour, Bailey, John Bailey, went missing, and Hancock went out to look for him. And he came across his body lying on the bank of the Limbrook Creek, and he went into the water on his horse, on horseback, to try and reach him. And handsome, a great horse rider, all the rest of it, he couldn't swim, and he drowned. And the two bodies were found side by side, washed up on the bank of the Limbrook Creek. They were brought back to Adelaide and kept in a lead coffin for a year before the actual interment. I can only assume that this was to allow time for relatives to come out from Ireland or from elsewhere. So looking into this, I found that Hancock was involved in the first steeplechase in South Australia in 1846, and there's a report in the paper of how that happened. It was a great event. It was held at Mount Osmond. And somebody fell off the horse, and Hancock rushed forward and leapt onto it and rode it towards the finish line. He didn't win, but, you know, he's in there doing this. He was such a dashing person. And I feel quite pleased that I've been able to drag this story from those old graves back before, because, you know, there was nothing to say. You couldn't tell. And every day that passes, and even now when it rains heavily or something, I'm lying in my bed thinking, oh, those stones will be getting more washed apart than ever. But anyway, at least now we know who's in there, don't we? I think I must be coming to the end of my time. And, you know, there's so many stories there that I can only touch on a very few of them. I'll just say briefly that the West Terrace Cemetery lays claim to a few firsts. One of them is that it had the first crematorium, the first working crematorium in Australia. It's not a very exciting subject, you might think, but remember that in the 1800s, cremation was a very controversial subject and for a long time. And I could talk on about the crematorium, the remains of which are still there, for a long time, but I'm running out of time. And the other first is its military cemetery, which you can see there, which was established really after the First World War. And it was down to lobbying by the League of Loyal Women, who were disturbed by the men returning from the First World War being buried in ordinary graves and not receiving the acclaim and the attention that they felt that they deserved. And to walk there is quite a sobering experience. Very formal, of course. There are tours of the military cemetery. In fact, I've become friends with the one of the volunteers who runs that and knows a lot about it, Philippa. So if you go up there and go on and say hello to Philippa, she knows a huge amount about the military cemetery. So finally, I think it's interesting, this compulsion we feel to gather the past and to stop it slipping away into the dark. And I think it's because we live always, if we were to live always in the moment, we would be living as children live. And it's all right for children, perhaps it's even necessary. But for adults, to know and understand the past makes the present infinitely richer. Faulkner famously said, "The past is never dead, it's not even past." And there were times at West Terrace when I felt that strongly. And here is Hilary Mantel again on history. History is not the past. It's the method we've evolved of organising our ignorance of the past. It's the record of what's left on the record. It's what's left in the sieve when the centuries have run through it. A few stones, scraps of writing, scraps of cloth. It's no more the past than a birth certificate is a birth, or a script is a performance, or a map is a journey. It's the multiplication of the evidence of fallible and biased witnesses combined with incomplete accounts of actions not fully understood by the people who performed them. It's no more than the best we can do, and often it falls short of that. She says, The historian, the biographer, the writer of fiction work within different constraints, but in a way that is complementary, not opposite. The novelist's trade is never just about making things up. The historian's trade is never simply about stockpiling facts. In my experience of wrestling the massive stories this historic site presented, of working them into a coherent shape, I drew on both disciplines. I did the best I could to retrieve these scraps of history from what was left in the sieve. And I very much hope I did the people and their stories justice, and that readers will find lasting pleasure in the result. So thank you all very much for coming tonight.